This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan All. It's Politics Day. There may be a vote on health care, but it may be done through a procedure called reconciliation. Depending on one's position on health care changes, reconciliation is either a procedural backdoor used to circumvent the system or common practice in the current congressional climate. The relationship between Israel and the United States is getting attention again. And the Obama administration is proposing changes to the Bush administration education plan known as No Child Left Behind. We'll have Stefan Schmidt from Iowa State University and New Hampshire political analyst Arnie Arneson on to talk about those issues. Also, your phone calls and email. You can email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or call 866-780-9100. Politics Day on Talk of Iowa coming up after this check of news from NPR and Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan All. It's Politics Day. That means our regular guests and your phone calls and emails. You can call us at 866-780-9100 or email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Arnie Arneson joins us on the line from New Hampshire. Good morning, Arnie. Do we have Arnie? Well, we'll try to get her in a minute. And Stefan Schmidt is also on the line this week, joining us from someplace that I presume is much warmer than Iowa. Good morning, Stefan.
Yes, good morning. I am at the Oceanographic Center in Fort Lauderdale, finishing up a conference and some meetings, and it's raining, so don't feel too bad. It's a little warmer, but it's not what people think, sitting out on the beach in the sun, so...
Well, we'll try to get... Is Arnie on the line now? Well, we're still working on that. Stefan, yep. You and I, until she gets here.
That's right.
One of the big things that's going on this week is it looks like we're getting closer to some kind of vote on health care using a procedure called reconciliation. And it appears that depending on your position on health care, reconciliation is either a subversive backdoor policy that's used to obfuscate truth and transparency, or it's kind of common practice now. Stefan, what's your take on reconciliation?
Yeah, you're right. You know, we've now wandered into the arcane and the territory that even political wonks rarely go into, and which means it's hard for the public to understand what this is. You have to understand that there are 1,000 different rules that the House and Senate manage their own procedures, and in order to do so have written and rewritten all kinds of rules that from time to time are used. And reconciliation is, in fact, a procedure whereby you can have the president sign a bill and then send it back without having the House and Senate actually vote on it, and then having the Congress, the majority in Congress, without the need for a 60-vote veto-proof majority, basically take that piece of legislation then and change it, improve it, put in things, take out things. And since the Democrats really still have a substantial majority until November, when the election comes, and they may not have a substantial majority then, they would be, in fact, be able to pass substantially health care reform. They're still bumping up against an odd problem, which is that the left of the Democratic Party is not very happy with the how far it has drifted from a progressive health care away from national health care, which never even was considered, but even from, you know, a kind of a public option where the government sort of provides a Medicare-type program that people can sign up for that competes with private insurance, all the way to conservative Democrats. You notice we're not even talking about Republicans at this point. They're sort of out of the picture. They don't want to have anything to do with any of this. But the conservative Democrats are still saying there are things in there we don't like. The Catholic bishops have now come out with a statement saying, well, we're now really opposed to this whole healthcare legislation, because even if you take out a specific mention that abortions can be funded from the provisions of this health care with public money, the Catholic bishops say we're going to get tricked when they do this reconciliation. If that's what they do, they're going to stick it back in there. So now the Catholic bishops are opposed. On the other hand, I just found out, I had a conversation earlier with Arneson, and she said, Stefan, you know, 2 minutes, 5 minutes ago, Dennis Kucinich finally came on board and said, yeah, okay, I'm going to vote for this thing, because he had been holding out. So it's just a really odd sort of history of this bill, and we can talk about this until something actually concrete happens. We don't know exactly where this is going to go. That Arnie had something else, which I'll be honest with you, I'm a political scientist, and I've written the best-selling American government textbook, and I have never heard of something called the self-executing rule, which apparently Nancy Pelosi all of a sudden has decided maybe the way to actually pass this thing. And if we can get Arnie on...
I'm here.
She's here. Hey.
Arnie is the only person in the United States who ever heard of the self-executing rule. And it sounds sort of like you know, suicide, but it isn't actually. So maybe...
Stefan, I'll give you a nicer expression. It's called deem and pass. Everyone remember, say this together, deem and pass. Yeah. And what's so interesting about all this is we've now moved into another phase of the healthcare reform debate. You ready? We call this procedural warfare. That's what this is.
That's right.
This is, and what you need to know, Jonathan, is I totally loved this because many, many, many years ago when I was a young woman and a legislator, boy, is that a long time ago, I remember trying to fight the incinerator industry. And the incinerator industry had just gotten a piece of legislation through in the wee hours of the night with no public hearing. They attached it to a Christmas tree bill, and there was no way I was going to get this bill killed because there was everything on this piece of legislation that somebody wanted, and there was no way that the bill was going to go down in total. So I went to my 82-year-old guru in the House, who is the queen of procedures, and I said to Betty, what the heck do I do? And she goes rumbling through all the rules, and she comes up with this genius plan, and guess what? We defeated the incinerator companies, we saved the rest of the bill, and I went off into glory, okay? So guess what? Nancy Pelosi has done the same thing. Here's the good news. The good news is more Republicans have used the self-executing rule than Democrats. Number one. Number two, some people are suggesting it is illegal. Well, Nancy Pelosi knows that because in 2005, she joined Public Citizen to try to defeat a bill that had been used and passed by the self-executing rule. And guess what? Nancy Pelosi lost. So she now knows it's legal. And because there is so much sort of fanaticism about this bill, disinformation about this bill, everybody's trying to genuflect to what are we going to do about abortion, what are we going to do about cost, what are we going to do about the Republicans, what about Scott Brown. This self-executing rule means that you only have one vote. You vote both on the Senate bill and on the reconciliation at the same time. So you kind of skip voting on the Senate bill, and by passing the second amended version, you've embraced the Senate version and the changes with one vote. It's actually very efficient.
I think
Republicans should like it because it's so streamlined, it's so efficient, but of course they're apoplectic because I will give you the downside about this self-executing rule is that while it's been used a number of times and lots of times, it has generally never been used on something of quite such a momentous issue, and this is healthcare reform, which we've been battling for decades and never seem to get our arms around.
But Arnie,
the reason for this is difficult.
But the interesting thing, Jonathan and Arnie, is that it may be precisely for the biggest and most difficult legislation that you have to use these procedures because otherwise you'd never get them done. I mean, I gave a talk to the Iowa Hospital Association. I went through the proposed Nixon, Carter, Clinton healthcare reform proposals. We looked at the statistics on how much, if Nixon had been able to get something through, healthcare reform would have helped keep down the cost. And if Carter had gotten it through, it would have helped more, but not as much, a little bit, but not as much, and so on and so forth. We've never been able to do it precisely because it's the big things that are just too large to pass. And so,
Stefan, I hate to interrupt. We got a great call on that topic, and I want to bring Fred from Waterloo in on that. Fred, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks. You know, I'm one of those, I don't know what you, independent. I'm not a Republican or Democrat. I'm more of a a moral conservative, but a social liberal, I guess. And I'm not really been out of shape about this whole use of reconciliation, even if I didn't agree with the need for health care, simply because maybe I'm way too simplistic in my understanding about this. But initially, under the Constitution, the reason for a super majority vote was simply for a constitutional amendment. And this idea, this need for the supermajority vote to even get it on the floor to vote up and down on it didn't come until quite a bit later through the use of changes in the rules in the Senate.
Yeah.
And so being a constitutional purist, it's not a big deal. I think you just need to let the process go through as designed, and we deal with the consequences as they come, if you have any faith in the system at all.
Well, it's interesting because we've made very large decisions that have had enormous consequences essentially without the Congress even being involved, much less being involved in some way like this. I'm talking about the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan, which have drained the treasury of this country, which have embroiled us in two wars, never with a declaration of war, simply with, you know, a kind of weak congressional authorization for an American president to use military force. And I don't see anybody raising that as a clear issue of lack of, you know, sound procedures. So, you know, you pick those when you like the policy, then it's okay, you know, that an American president really without congressional approval, without solid congressional approval, long-term approval, got us into two big wars that we're still in. But on health care reform, oh, no, it's got to be passed by a super-duper majority.
And the caller made a fabulous point, and the most important thing he said was, we're going to have to then see the party, in this case the Democratic Party, is going to have to live with the consequences of their actions. And you know what? Actions do have consequences. They do have a majority. They could technically, on paper, control Congress. Well, then they have to damn act. And if it means reconciliation, self-executing, pulling a rabbit out of the hat, you've got the numbers, sweetheart. And even though they've made it difficult in the Senate with the 60 vote and the supermajority, there are ways around it. There are the nuclear option, reconciliation, I don't care what you want to call it. And let's be honest here, nobody is of one mind on this issue, even the damn church. The Catholic Church has said, the bishops say, we don't want this bill because of the potential that some of the money might be used to pay for abortions. Well, they better talk to the Catholic hospitals, because the Catholic hospitals just weighed in, and they said, we do want this bill passed. We do need it. So even within the church, there is a split. So the fact is, actions have consequences, and we will have to see what the consequences are of the Democrats' health care reform bill. Good, bad, or indifferent, we will have to live with that result.
We have to take a quick break. Fred from Waterloo, thank you very much for your call. More of your calls and emails after this break. You can email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, or you can call 866-780-9100 to talk to us, give a comment, ask a question of Stefan Schmidt, Arnie Arneson. They're our guests on Politics Day here on Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aul. Stefan Schmidt from Iowa State University is with us, as is Arnie Arneson, New Hampshire-based political analyst. We're taking your phone calls and emails, 866-780-9100. You can also email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. To wrap up the discussion on the whole reconciliation issue, it seems that every time a new procedural thing comes up that would lessen the amount of votes needed to pass it, it gives ammunition for people who are further down the special interest chain. And I'm wondering, yeah, Stefan, Arnie, if you could comment on the public option. Do you think that because it's going from 60 to 51 votes to pass something using these procedural messages or these procedural things, that all of a sudden the public option that maybe 40 or so people in the Senate support, is there any life to that at all, do you think?
No.
I don't think so either.
Yeah. I think as much as it breaks my heart, I think that here's the irony is we said we've had a full-throated conversation about health care reform in America. That is absolutely not true. We never really had a chance to talk about single payer. We never had a chance to talk really about public option. So many things have been pulled out so early on that this has been a very controlled conversation where insurance reform is really what we're doing.
Yeah.
We are not doing health care reform. We have limited our discussion to insurance reform, period.
Yeah, and I think the yowling is going to be loud enough, whatever is passed, no matter how modest, that I think the Democrats are not going to want the volume on the yowling to be magnified by going back and putting in the most, let's call it most controversial pieces, even though Arnie is right. They may not be so controversial, but perceived as controversial. So I think they'll probably pass something that looks like the Senate bill. I can I just add something here? People ask me this almost every single day. Stefan, what do you think? Are you supporting the health care reform bill? And my answer is, I really don't know, because I don't know exactly what is going to be in it, and I don't understand the synergisms of all the things that are in it and exactly how those are going to affect cost, availability of health care, and so on. So I'm myself somewhat of a cautious skeptic, you know, and we do need to do something because the system is slowly basically imploding. I mean, I'm just down in Miami, one the biggest public health hospital in Miami now is $1 billion or something like that in debt. They are freaking out because it's the place where everybody goes who can't afford health care, and as a result, they've had these enormous costs. And now those folks are going to apparently go to the emergency room in the hospitals that the middle class and wealthy people use because emergency rooms have to take patients, and it's going to create enormous chaos in the ERs of hospitals that are not for the poor, but are for the people who have those Cadillac insurance policies and so on. So it was an incredible example of how the middle class and the upper class in the United States really needs to be aware that the health care problem is going to visit them at their door, in their waiting rooms, in their ERs, unless we improve the system. This is not an issue of, you know, giving health insurance and coverage to a bunch of poor people. It's fixing a system that is bleeding out in all directions.
And Jonathan, there are just two more sidebars here. One is that Bernie Sanders, who's the very, very liberal slash socialist slash, you know, independent in the Senate, has also made sure that people know that while single payer was never discussed and was totally ignored, there is a provision in the Senate bill that will not be amended out that allows states to experiment with a single payer concept. And that means states could do it. States could join other states to do it. And when I ran for governor back in 1992 in New Hampshire, I actually talked about a tri-state single-payer plan with Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont. That was way back in 1992. Those kinds of creative concepts might be possible now if healthcare reform does pass. And that's a good news story, because if you know anything about what happened in Canada, Canada did not pass their single-payer plan as a country. They passed it province by province. And then after the experiments took place, they then embraced it as a nation. So anything that allows us some creativity, some flexibility, whether it's the Massachusetts model that Scott Brown voted for or the Bernie Sanders single-payer concept, at least if nothing else, we're beginning to move somewhat forward in the area of accessibility and accountability with health care. I think that's so important to know.
Let's go to the phone. John from the Quad Cities is on. John, welcome to Talk of Iowa.
Hi. A question on this financing of this monstrosity. This fund is going to grow for like, what, 3 years or so before anybody can touch it. And all the money is going to go into one big pot. What makes anybody think that this monster pot is going to be managed any better than what Medicare is with whoever is overseeing this monster? And where's the better system part of this thing?
John, thanks for your call. I'm going to go with that John is not in favor of the bill.
Yeah, yeah. But he's asking a good question because
yeah.
he is
so answer
he's,
it, guys.
Concerned, you know, the way a lot of people are. What exactly does this thing look like? Is there going to be just one gigantic pot of money? I think the answer is no. This is not Medicare. There are all kinds of provisions in it in which there are negotiations with insurance companies. There are all kinds of things in it that actually don't require funding, but instead require consultation and negotiation between healthcare providers, insurance companies, and so on. So, you know, it is not a socialist national healthcare system in which you are basically dumping all this insurance money into a big pot and doling
it out.
We have
a little reality therapy here, though, everyone. Wait a second. We're acting like there isn't a growing pot right now.
Well, that's right.
We're acting like the cost of insurance isn't going up by double digits.
Sure.
We're acting like we're not hearing about 26%, 36%, 40% increases in insurance. Excuse me, folks. But
yeah.
that's exactly what's happening. And one of the reasons to do this, Jonathan, let's assume that we're not going to be doing too well on the employment front. As scary as that sounds, that we're going to see relatively high employment for a long period of time. Now, the problem with that is that you can only spend so much on COBRA, but what ends up happening is unless you have some kind of requirement that people play in the health insurance system, then the only people that are going to choose health insurance are the sickest. And that's going to drive the cost of healthcare up. As long as we get more people in the system, some who are slightly sick, some who are very healthy, some who are somewhat old, some who are very old, you actually keep insurance at a more reasonable cost. But anytime you create an option so that quasi-healthy people who think they're healthy for the moment decide to drop out, you have driven the cost of insurance up by 10, 20, 30, and 40%. So it isn't a, you know, a zero-sum game. It's not like nothing is growing under the current system, and it will only grow because now we have healthcare reform. Wake up and smell the coffee. The system is imploding now and costing us more now.
We started,
if you change it by a percent, you've done a big difference.
No.
We started this discussion by talking about procedure. Let's end it with talking about procedure. When the Republicans were in the majority, they thought the filibuster was horrible. Democrats said it was important. When the Democrats are in the majority, they say the filibuster is horrible, and the Republicans said that it was important. And there's a long history of both sides wanting it when they were in the minority and opposing it when they were in the majority. Going through all of this, Steph and Arnie, do you believe that Congress and the Senate will make any significant changes to the filibuster rule, or will it just keep going back and forth that it will be embraced by the minority and opposed by the majority?
You're right.
Well, I don't think they're going to make, you know, any major provisions, because at times both of them have found the filibuster to be important to them, and they have it sitting there as a tool. But I think clearly that there is now a realization that this could be, in a polarized political situation where you have no bipartisanship, the filibuster could simply be lights off in Congress, nothing ever gets passed in the Senate, because if every piece of legislation is threatened with a filibuster and that's enough to derail it, you can't do business.
And people don't live and die and go to a doctor on procedure. They live and die and go to a doctor or do whatever on a bill that changes their life and changes their access. And as much as Republicans are going to use the fact that they didn't vote on the Senate bill or they're going to wag their finger about procedure, I hate to break it to you, most Americans are not going to look at the procedure issue. They're going to look at the policy and see how it impacted their business, their lives, and their state. That will be where the bill will be evaluated.
We're going to take a break for the Environment Report, and when we come back, we will talk about Israel and education. Those topics are coming up after this break here on Politics Day on Talk of Iowa with Stephen Schmidt from Iowa State University, Arnie Arneson from New Hampshire. Your phone calls and emails at 866-780-9100, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Jonathan Aull. It's 10:30. We'll be back in just a few minutes. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull. It's Politics Day. Stephen Schmidt from Iowa State University and New Hampshire political analyst Arnie Arneson are on the line with us. We're going to be talking about Israel and education in just a moment. But before we do that, Arnie and Stephen, we got an email in over the break that I thought would be a little sorbet before we get into another topic. Jeff from Rock Island wants to know, if Congress posts proposed bills for the public to read online, It would help clear up so many false rumors and lies if citizens could just read what's being proposed so that people can have a clear opinion about bills. It could alleviate the spreading lies and scare tactics, as well as having to not rely on the news and politicians to tell the truth. So Jeff from Rock Island wants to know that. To what extent are the bills that are actually being debated posted where the public can get to them?
They're all posted pretty much. I mean, go to the Congress website, the gov.gov website. And
House.gov and Senate.gov?
Yeah, that's right. You can read them. But, you know, let me add something. It's a tragedy, but the American public doesn't have the time and probably not the interest either to research all these things. They certainly don't have the time. Even if you're retired, you know, it would drive you crazy to try and read through a congressional piece of legislation that's in for markup and for debate and so on. We have a lot of statistics on how little people avail themselves of all of the information that is available on politics, for example, on the internet. People don't go and read the websites of candidates to find out their positions on issues. In fact, people don't go and to the internet even to look and see what the weather is in the location to which they are flying. And I can attest to that because a lady waiting at the airport in Detroit, boarding the same plane I was, well, the man next to her said, well, the reason the plane is late because of the weather. And she said, what weather? Well, the weather was that in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, there was one of the most severe weather fronts they've had in years going through with 8 inches of rain, thunderstorms, lightning, several tornadoes. She didn't know. She was flying down there for vacation, but she didn't know because she didn't even bother to check the weather. It's not very likely that people, except for the person who emailed you, would go and if they went, understand the legislation, because raw legislation is like statistics. If you give somebody a gigantic spreadsheet with 1,000 pieces of data on it and you read it, you probably go away more confused than enlightened. So I'm sorry to say that there are places that are more reliable where these things are explained to people. They're condensed so that they are not spin and are not distorted and are not people yelling at each other. And it's better to go there than to the raw material.
Well, Jeff from Rock Island, you can be more learned and go read the bills, and hopefully other people will do that as well. Let's go to the topics that we have suggested. Let's start with Israel. And Arnie, this is one of the topics you wanted to talk about this week, so I'll let you start.
Well, you know, it's once again, it's the whole idea of the settlements and what Israel is doing in an attempt to, you know, try to get some kind of reconciliation between the Palestinians and the Israelis. Bibi Netanyahu knows exactly how not to have that happen. And he not only knows how not to have that happen, but he knows how to insult a vice president like Joe Biden. When Joe Biden goes to visit Israel, they announce, 1,600 buildings that are going to be built just outside of Jerusalem. And, of course, everything went to hell in a handbasket. But the reason I want to talk about the Israeli-Palestinian problem is that it isn't limited to that. And if you read, and I have in front of me the copy of some comments by General David Petraeus from CENTCOM, and this is what he said to the Senate Armed Services Committee, because it is so important that we focus like a laser on what's happening between the Israelis and the Palestinians, because it is impacting us around the world. And Petraeus says, the enduring hostilities between Israel and some of its neighbors present distinct challenges to our ability to advance our interests in the AOR, and the AOR is area of responsibility, including things like Pakistan and Afghanistan and Iran and Iraq, that whole area. Israeli-Palestinian tensions often flare into violence and large-scale armed confrontations. The conflict, listen to these words, everyone, the conflict foments anti-American sentiment due to a perception of U.S. favoritism for Israel. Arab anger over the Palestinian question limits the strength and depth of U.S. partnerships with governments and peoples in the area of responsibility and weakens the legitimacy of moderate regimes in the Arab world. Meanwhile, al-Qaeda and other militant groups exploit that anger to mobilize support. So I just want people to hear this, because what happens in Israel does impact the safety and security of our men and women in Afghanistan, of our men and women in Iraq. And there is a connection here. And while Netanyahu seems to somehow ignore that and doesn't mind slapping the hand of its largest financial contributor to the safety and security of Israel, which is the U.S., we need to understand that these actions have consequences for our men and women serving in the armed services.
Let's take a quick call on this. Craig from Palos on the, or Carl rather from Palos on the line. Carl, welcome to the show.
Hi, Jonathan. Great show again. Say, Arnie, you know, you just said exactly what I wanted to say, and we're on the same page. And it is sad that the Israelis don't see that themselves. You know, like you just can't treat people like Israel treats the Palestinians. I mean, you know, just taking their water, even building, even putting stone quarries in their properties, and taking the stones and building roads where they, where the Palestinians can't drive on. You know, that's just a, I mean, it's just terrible. I mean, nobody would take that.
Well, and I think one of the things that they're suggesting that, I mean, Obama is trying to present a different face to the world, and part of what I think Israel is, and Israel is being tone deaf. They're being tone deaf. They're not acting in their own self-interest. They're actually undermining their self-interest unless they want to be in a perpetual state of war. And I'm frankly, I'm not sure most people want that for any country, let alone Israel. But on top of that, what is going on, I think, is Obama is really trying to say to Netanyahu, you do this. We're going to try to really dismantle your government. You need to bring more moderate voices into this world because you need to have real conversation and come to the table with something close to clean hands when you're sitting down with the Palestinians. The Palestinians have agreed not to sort of foment some rebellion for the last 15 months vis-a-vis Israel, and then you turn around, and this isn't even done for your safety and security. Where you're placing these settlements has nothing to do with the security of Israel. Nothing.
Let me make a point. Carl, I'm on the same page, too. I mean, I think that the Israelis have really been very blind to the fact that they are coming close to the edge where the United States is going to simply walk away and say, you know, we've tried, we've given you the second largest amount of foreign aid. Israel and Egypt, are still the recipients of the largest amount of non-military foreign aid by the United States, and it just hasn't done very much. But you know what the real problem in Israel is, and Arnie knows this? The Israeli political system is completely broken. They have elections. They are democratic. But in Israel, it is always a tiny, extreme religious party that gives the prime minister the majority to rule. And those small, tiny little parties with almost no members in the Knesset are the ones who push and insist that the Palestinian territory is the ancient homeland of Jews, and who push the settlements policy, and who always yank the Israeli government to the right. The Israelis would do very well to fix their political system so the majority is representative of the majority opinion of Israel and not dependent on a tiny little party to make the parliamentary majority. You know, parliamentary systems can be very weak. Italy used to have a government every 6 months because Italy had so many little parties, and they would join the government to get a ministry of culture or something, and then they'd stomp out, and then the prime minister doesn't have a majority and has to call for a new election or form a new government. This is a structural problem as well as a kind of cultural or historic problem, and the structural part has to be fixed, or this is going to continue exactly the way it is now, because it is the tiny splinter, very, very radical conservative parties that force the prime minister's hands on things.
The out question here. While I understand both what you're saying, there are still a lot of people in the United States who have a great amount of support for Israel. A lot of people in the United States would have a different position on how the Palestinians are being treated and whether it's appropriate or not. How does the U.S. government approach this then in a way that preserves its interests, the divergent interests of different groups in the United States, and in a way that doesn't foster more conflict between these two organizations, between these two peoples?
Well, that is the dilemma. There's an interesting blog post by a guy named Iglesias or something like that, and he says this whole region is tied up in the knots of contradiction, N-O-T-S, not K-N-O-T-S, but the knots of contradiction. And that's part of the problem right now, Jonathan, is that even there is no one mind, even within the American Jewish community, about Israel. That what just happened, for example, with the settlement issue and what Bibi did, has got the Jewish community split on this issue. It can't be you look the other way just because it's Israel, and they have been an important ally in the Middle East. There is no question. But that doesn't mean that you give them this blank slate and say you can do whatever you want, because in the end, not only are they harming our interests in the Middle East, they're actually harming themselves. And Stefan just proved that point by saying, here, this little tiny religious group within Netanyahu's cobbled-together government is what decided that at that moment they wanted to start moving on their settlement issue. Did Netanyahu know they were going to do it? Not really, he says. But you know what? It happened on his watch.
And it happens all the time, because the Shah's party and the other little tiny religious, extreme parties, let's say, are always dictating policy. I would also add, and we can't go away from this conversation without reminding ourselves, that Israel has probably the most effective lobby of any lobby that lobbies on foreign policy, and that's AIPAC, the American Israel Political Action Committee. I have students who intern there. In fact, I have one there right now, and they are fantastically efficient. They have excellent, excellent representation in their lobbying system with lawyers and others. They drill into a part of the American Jewish community, which is quite small in numbers, but is very well educated and well positioned. And so Israel has an enormous public interest or kind of a lobbying interest advantage over, say, the Palestinians. Now, an interesting development. Luis Ignacio Lula da Silva, who is the Brazilian president, just landed in Israel, apparently. I'm reading this in Asia Times Online by Pepe Escobar, and has gone there to try and bring the Palestinians and Israelis back to a conversation using his good office and the Brazilian, not the American, good offices, and also negotiating with Israel to try and have a conversation apparently with Iran, which is very, very interesting. And it may be that the thing that breaks these log jams is, in fact, a larger role by others, such as Brazil and others, in trying to reconcile these conversations. Because the United States is, in fact, not seen necessarily by Arabs or by Palestinians as a neutral party, because it isn't, you know. It's
exactly
not a neutral party. Now, it would help if the Palestinians were to definitively and finally declare that Israel has the right to exist as a state and not continue to have at least, you know, some of the Palestinian groups continue to have this official position that Israel is not a state. They don't even call it a country. They call it an entity. I'm surprised they don't call it, you know, like a tumor or something, because that's how they feel about it. And that has led to an enormous amount of correctly perceived concern on the part of Israelis, who have of course been invaded by their Arab neighbors several times and have had to fight some very intense wars just to survive. So, you know, everybody has got to chill out, sit down, and put something on the table. And I think if the Palestinians don't put on the table their guarantee that Israel, in some way, shape, or form, maybe not the current one, with the current borders, is a legitimate state and has the right to exist, the Israelis are going to continue to be very concerned. So that's a
problem
as well.
And I don't always recommend Maureen Dowd, but on this issue, you might want to read her piece today entitled Bibi's Tense Time Out by Maureen Dowd. And she always is so creative with her language.
That's right.
And she incorporates a lot of background information that's important. So just my recommendation is go to the New York Times, read Maureen Dowd, Bibi's Tense Time Out. It's a pretty fascinating description of the problem for both Obama and for Netanyahu.
I'd like to spend a little bit of time on education in the final minutes of the show here. U.S. Secretary of Education Arne Duncan was in Des Moines and Cedar Rapids over the weekend. Among his first stops, promoting the Obama administration's plans to make changes to the education policy known as No Child Left Behind. And even though it does such things as limits punishing schools that are underperforming to the worst 5%, allows more local control, allows more schools to use different ways to assess their performance, it's still getting a very cold reception from teachers' unions and many school officials. Arne and Stefan, do you think that this education thing will become a lightning rod, or do you think it'll pass mostly as the administration has proposed it?
It is a lightning rod. Lightning has already struck, and the reason is the United States is one of those very odd countries that doesn't have a national education policy. Really, I mean, No Child Left Behind was essentially the same, you know, where they dangle money in front of you, but it didn't take a hands-on national curriculum and so on. And most of other countries have that education much more centralized. We hate centralization. We have not only federalism, but in the case of education, we have provincialism, really, because school boards and teachers' unions are all pulverized all over the place. And it's the battle of, you know, I don't remember how many school districts there are in the United States, but each one of them wants to maintain control over as much of what they do, how they do it, and so on as they can. And so anytime you try to mess with education from Washington, D.C., you're going to have a lot of trouble on your hands. And in fact, and this is a real shame, too, the Constitution really doesn't give the federal government the power to do anything with education, you know, indirectly perhaps. But education is a states' rights issue and a federal issue in which, a federalist issue in which the states really have control and the school boards have some control under that. And so when you try to impose any kind of national standards and national punishments and so on them, they're going to squeal. So it's going to be tough.
But he did listen to Republicans on this bill. So you need to know that he was very, very bipartisan as he moved forward on this. So I want to mention that.
Yeah.
He also recognized that you just don't have to be proficient in reading and math. Things like civics and science matter. Ooh, how exciting. I mean, that's pretty impressive. And the other thing he does is that what is so important is, remember the operative word, even though he's changing the name, it's no longer going to be No Child Left Behind. But the concept of No Child is going to be left. And what I mean by that is that they're going to look at the improvement of each student.
That's right.
So you don't take this generic class.
Not school. That's right.
Each student. And the most important thing is, if little Johnny comes in at a second grade level, does he move to a third grade level? And even if little Johnny's in fifth grade but starts at a second grade level, is he moving up the ladder? Because that's the most important thing. Is the student improving? And that should be the test.
But the problem is, in the piece that I did for Inside for the Des Moines Register on education, and it got a lot of buzz, I said, you know, you cannot expect a kid in a school to improve just by having the teacher be the source of education. I mean, what you're doing there, you're schooling. You're not educating. If the parents don't participate, don't have an education, mistreat their kid, the home environment is terrible, the teachers shouldn't be punished, because the teachers have nothing to work with if that's the case. And if school districts in poor schools in, you know, Kansas City or places like that are broke, the community is broken, the neighborhoods are broken, you know, the kid isn't going to learn anything.
The problem with this timing is that states across the country are slashing their education funding budget. And the irony is, remember that big shadoo about the Rhode Island school system that fired all the teachers?
Yeah.
And one of the things they put on the table in order not to fire them was, they said to the teachers, we will give you all this time to do education improvement and go back to school to improve your teaching skills, but you just won't be paid for that time. And the teachers union said, forget that. And then what does it turn out? The entire state of Rhode Island took all the money out of any kind of improvement in teachers in the classroom. So the irony was, even what they offered to fix the school in this particular school, that amount of investment was eliminated across the board in Rhode Island.
Well, and
how
the,
do you fix schools if you're basically devastating them
but look,
economically?
The education community, however, Arnie, itself is also very reluctant to talk about family environment, parents, and so on. I mean, in Iowa, we've had all these articles about education because the Des Moines Register is hugely interested in it and has stuff all the time on it. But they really, they talk about Finland, you know, they talk about the best schools in Canada. Do you think they ever mention that those are very racially, ethnically, and otherwise homogeneous places with a very middle-class population, whereas the United States is a country that is fractured, that has a tremendously complicated sociology? No, they never mentioned that. I mean, yeah, of course Finland can have good schools. They spend a lot of money on it. They don't have, you know, the divisive conditions, school busing, integration, and all these wars that in some cases actually devastated a
but
lot of
I am going to tell you something, just because you could, if you're going to knock Finland for all you Finns out there, one of the things they did do was they recognized they were in the middle of the pack in Europe when it came to education performance. They decided they wanted to change it.
Sure.
They were able to change it and reform it. And today in Finland, the most prestigious job, as prestigious if not more so than doctor or lawyer, is teacher.
Right.
In this country, being a teacher doesn't gain you respect. Sorry, honey, it doesn't work the same.
Well, that's right. And that's partly due because they are a very different society from the United States in every respect, and we keep coming back to that. The United States has a very odd history in terms of education, and, you know, we are not Finland. I mean, even when we decide we're going to restructure everything, we pour huge amounts of money into schools, and the kids still don't learn anything. There are many schools like that. Washington, D.C. is a good example.
Unfortunately, that's all the time we have today on Talk of Iowa. Stephen Schmidt, Arnie Arneson, guys, thanks for being on the show as always. Our program is produced by Dennis Reese. Assistance today from Jeff Schmidt and John Pemble. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa is available at iowapublicradio.org, including in Finland. You can contact us anytime at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme was composed and performed by Dan Knight. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Jonathan Aull. Thanks for joining us.